The room felt overly warm, uncomfortably so. As Paul peeled off his jacket, Cardenas leaned over one of the keyboards and typed out a single command. A shutter slid back from the blank wall on Paul's right, and he saw a window that looked into another room. An ancient Cadillac sat in there, one of those old monsters heavy with chrome and tail fins. Bright red, where there was paint still on it. Almost half the side that Paul could see was dull, bare metal. The car was up on blocks, although the rear tire was still on its hub. The front tire was gone. The hood was propped up part way. The windshield wipers were gone. "What's this?" Paul asked. "A pop art exhibit?" Cardenas grinned at him. "It's our toxic waste exhibit. What do you think of it?" Paul turned back to stare at the Cadillac through the thick window. "Nanobugs are taking it apart?" She nodded happily. "We've got 4 different types of specialized gobblers in there."
"Gobblers?"
"Nanomachines specifically designed to attack certain molecules, break them apart into their constituent atoms."
"Gobblers?" Paul repeated.
"One set's taking out the paint," Cardenas explained. "Another is reducing the organic molecules in the tires to carbon dioxide, methane, and whatnot. The third is working on the engine, separating out all the tungsten and platinum in the steel alloys."
"Tungsten and platinum?"
"They're valuable metals, you know. We want to separate them out so we can recycle them."
"I see," said Paul.
"And the fourth set of nanos is gobbling the plastics in the dashboard, steering wheel, seat covers and such."
Paul could see the sheer fervor of achievement radiating from her face. A muffled bang made him snap his attention back to the Cadillac. The one tire remaining had just blown out and now hung limply on its hub. Paul thought he could see it twitching like something alive being devoured by parasites.
"Why do you keep the car in a sealed chamber?" he asked.
"To keep the bugs from spreading, of course," Cardenas answered. "We keep the chamber at 10 below 0 Celsius. The bugs are programmed to stop at any temperature above 0.
"But why?"
"To make sure they won't start gobbling people."
"Oh." Paul hadn't thought of that.
Cardenas didn't seem the least bit condescending as she explained.
"The bugs don't see any difference between your molecules and the Cadillacs, you know. Except temperature. We designed them to immobilize themselves way before they get to human body temperature."
Paul nodded slowly. "Then how do you expect to use them in toxic waste dumps if you're worried that they might attack people?"
Her smile faded slightly.
"We're working on that problem. We've got to make them much more specific than they are now. Much more specific. Tailor them to distinctive molecules so they'll gobble up those molecules and nothing else."
"Can you do that?"
"In time," she replied.
"Time costs money," Paul knew.
It was the old story, an exciting new possibility that could make fortunes of profit, but first you have to sink fortunes of investment into it and pray that it eventually succeeds.
"What else do you have?" he asked.
Cardenas went back to the control console, flicked her fingers across a different keyboard. Another section of shutters slid back, this time on Paul's left.
"Nanomachines can build things too, you know," Cardenas said.
At first, Paul thought he was looking at a sandcastle, the kind that kids build on the beach. The chamber he was looking into was hardly larger than a phone booth, dimly lit by a single bare bulb in the ceiling. Its floor was covered with sand, or a grayish-brown powder of some sort. In the middle of it stood a half-built tower.
"Here we've got assemblers at work," Cardenas said, her voice low, almost a reverential whisper.
Paul studied the tower. It was about 3 feet tall. It wasn't made of sand, he realized. It was gray, almost the same color as the stuff strewn over the floor, but it looked smoother, metallic.
"What is this?"
In the dim light from the display screens, Cardenas' expression was difficult to read, but her voice was vibrating with barely suppressed excitement.
"Last week, Mr. Masterson phoned me with a special request. This is the result."
"What did Greg want?"
"That sand is from the moon," Cardenas said. "We've put in a few simple assemblers, and the tower is what they're building."
"Assemblers? You mean nanomachines?"
She nodded eagerly.
"Actually, we put 100 assemblers into the sand 5 days ago."
"And they've built the tower," Paul said.
"They're still building it. Watch real careful and you can see new features being added." Paul turned and stared at the tower rising out of the lunar sand. It rose perpendicularly from a wide, low base, its flanks smooth and featureless except for small setbacks every foot or so.
"Nothing seems to be happening," he said.
Cardenas peered at the tower.
"They stop every once in a while, like they're taking a coffee break. Then they get busy again."
"Don't you know why they stop?"
"For sure."
She grinned.
"Each time they reach a change in the blueprint we programmed into them, they stop until the proper members of the team are in the right position to start the new phase of the building."
Paul's eyes widened. "You make them sound as if they're intelligent."
"About as intelligent as bacteria," Cardenas replied.
Paul grunted.
"The assemblers spent the first 4 days building more of themselves out of the aluminum and silicon in the sand. Yesterday, that tower wasn't here."
"No shit," Paul breathed.
"The tower is mainly titanium, you know. The assemblers are taking titanium atoms preferentially from the sand and using them to build the tower."
"How do they know?"
"It's all programmed into them," Cardenas said. "We did this sort of thing last year as a demonstration for Mr. Masterson and his father when they visited here.
We didn't use lunar sand then, just beach sand. We built a really neat castle for them."
Paul looked at her. "Could you build more complex stuff?"
Without an eye blink's hesitation, Cardenas said,
"We could build a whole base on the moon for you, if you give us the time to program the assemblers."
Paul saw that there were a couple of little wheeled typist chairs by the consoles. He pulled one up and sank onto it. Cardenas took the other one, facing him.
"Instead of sending tons and tons of heavy machinery to the moon," she said, leaning toward him, "all you'd have to do is send a sampling of the necessary assemblers. They'll build more of themselves out of the raw materials in the moon's soil,"
"regolith," Paul corrected automatically,
"and then they'll construct your base out of the regolith," she stressed the word, "all by themselves."
"One shipload of nanomachines," Paul mused.
"Could build your whole base for you," she said.
"How long would it take you to develop the nanomachines? Specifically for Moonbase, I mean." She waved her hands in the air.
"Simple tasks, like building airtight shelter shells and other construction forms, that's pretty easy. When you get down to complicated equipment, like air regenerators and pressure pumps, we'll need a while to program the assemblers."
"A while? How long?"
"Months. Maybe years. We've never tried to build anything very complicated. Not yet. It'll take some time."
A new thought struck Paul. "Most of the compounds in the regolith are oxygen-bearing, and there's hydrogen embedded in the top layers of the regolith, blown in on the solar wind.
Could your machines produce water out of those atoms? For sure. That's no problem."
"Jesus H. Christ on a motorcycle."
"You want a motorcycle? We'll build you a motorcycle."
Cardenas laughed. "Maybe we ought to be talking with Harley," Paul kidded back.
"Or General Motors."
She was suddenly completely serious. In flight. Paul was in the company helicopter heading back to San Francisco International Airport when his pocket phone beeped. It was Melissa.
"Delta's flight's been canceled," she said, "and there's nothing connecting to Savannah until late tonight. Can I ride back with you?"
"Sure," Paul said, knowing it was a mistake, not knowing how to say no without feeling like a jerk.
Melissa was waiting for him in the hangar where his twin-engine jet was sheltered, the same plane in which he and Joanna had made love for the first time. Melissa was standing beside the plane looking slightly forlorn in a baggy pair of tan slacks and a light sweater that hung loosely on her.
"Sorry to impose on you," she said as soon as Paul got to within arm's reach. "I'd have to fly the red-eye to Atlanta and then make a connection at 6 tomorrow morning otherwise."
"It's okay," Paul said. Last night they had been in bed together. But that was last night.
Melissa picked up her single garment bag.
"I know I look a mess. This is my airline outfit. It's for comfort, not looks."
He made a smile for her.
"You look fine, kid."
As he walked toward the plane beside Melissa, Paul remembered his elderly grandfather on the day the news broke that the first black president of the United States had been caught in the sack with a woman who was not his wife. His grandfather had shaken his head mournfully.
"See the trouble a man's cock can get him into?"
"Yeah, I see, Gramps.
But seeing ain't the same thing as doing.